studying through the subject of church history for quite some time, coming to the end of the period we're going to be studying anyways, up through the Reformation. And we have come to the life of John Calvin. Last week we found Calvin in Strasbourg, having been kicked out of Geneva, he and William Farrell. I didn't note last week, during this period of time, Calvin had also developed a very close relationship with a fellow by the name of Peter Verrey, and that relationship would continue throughout his life. Calvin only had a certain number of very close friends, Verrey and Farrell being two of them. I think one of the reasons that he may have maintained those friendships as long as he did is that he very rarely was ministering in the same place they were. I wonder if one of the reasons that they got along so well is that they didn't have to be around each other every single day. In essence, they ministered in different places and kept contact with one another by letter. And indeed, Calvin's letters are a fascinating insight, especially those written to people like Farrell and Verrey. They tend to be more personal. And it is interesting to note the his own recognition of his own shortcomings and failings that are found in those letters. After Calvin returns to Geneva, I mentioned last week the letter from Sadoleto, the situation where the Genevan Council votes to ask Calvin to return. They recognize that the city is in a need of his strong hand, and he is not interested in coming back. He resists their asking him for quite some time, but he always has in the back of his mind this feeling that he had been called to ministry there and that he really could not in any way resist that calling that had been placed upon him, despite the fact that he did not want to be there. And it wouldn't be only a number of years later to where his letters and journals would record his deep desire to be released from that position, because he knew, even when he finally gave in to the pleas of the Genevans to return from Strasbourg to Geneva, he knew at that time that it was not going to be easy. He knew that if he was going to be consistent with his own beliefs in regards to how the church should exist in Geneva, that he was going to have to basically go right back to where he was before in the attempt to strengthen and enforce the laws of the church. He knew that Geneva had not changed as far as the people that were there. So he knew he was going back into lion's den. And so he dreaded going back, and even after he does go back, there are certain situations where he, to use the scholarly term, responds with immoderation to someone. In other words, especially in situations of conflict, and especially when he was being very unfairly accused of things, Calvin could unleash his intellect and his tongue and basically rip the lips off somebody. And in so doing, he himself, in one of his letters, I think, I can't remember whether it was Farrell or Verrey, he makes reference to the response that he had had given to someone, and he refers to it as a grievous sin. He recognized the fact that he had a tendency to anger, especially when being falsely accused. In one situation, one man who very, very unstable, and I think this is one of the reasons, I'll be honest with you, there are a couple things where I see things in Calvin that that I have personal connection with. I run into a lot of unstable people, and there is one man who went back and forth. He left home and then went back and then came back out. And for some reason, people kept giving him positions of leadership when he'd leave, but then he'd end up going back, and he eventually died in the Roman Communion, who accused Calvin of Trinitarian heresies, and specifically of denying the deity of Christ. And it was so absurd that Calvin had a problem in dealing with people who were simply absurd. He had a problem in dealing with people who just, you know, weren't playing with a full deck of cards, in essence. And I run into a lot of folks who aren't playing with a full deck of cards, and I understand the sense of frustration that that he confesses that normally came out not in so much in his dealing with his regular duties as it was in dealing with individuals who claimed to be Christians and yet simply refused to think logically, rationally, and to engage in meaningful biblical exegesis. Those kind of folks drove him nuts, and I'll be perfectly honest with you, they drive me nuts too. And the more I've written, the more I have encountered people who, when I look at Calvin's life, and I look at Bolsec, and I look at Servetus, and I look at these others, I go, I know exactly what those kind of people were, because I've got the exact same kind of folks. We're going to get into Servetus eventually, and man, talk about a study in personality that I could give you a dozen names of people I know right now that are very much like this individual. So it's very interesting that works out that way. Did we miss something? I'm so accustomed to hearing that alarm that I'm sitting here going, No, it wasn't mine. I guess that means Bible study starting here. That, or did you program one to wake yourself up in the middle of White's Sunday school lesson? Would that be the time to go to sleep now? Okay, all right. I'm going to beam you a virus while you're not looking. Anyways, it is interesting to look at the personal things. No one is ever going to claim that Calvin was a perfect man. And the nice thing, though, is to realize that when he wrote to his friends and to his spiritual peers, shall we say, he recognized those things and confessed those things. Now, as I mentioned, just to sort of get the context, remember Calvin's in Strasbourg. You have the Sodaletto issue. He writes his commentary on Romans. He marries Idelette de Bure, who was a widow of an Anabaptist who was converted at Strasbourg. They lose a child. She dies only a few years later. Both of them are always in poor health. There was never really a period of unrestrained health from this time forward for Calvin. Calvin basically lives a 27-year headache, which, if we are any indication, we generally use headaches as an excuse for almost any sort of behavior on our part, so I guess anything could be excused. But we take it for granted. We have aspirin and Tylenol and Advil and naproxen sodium Aleve and all this wonderful fun stuff, and he didn't, and obviously didn't have a chiropractor around either. So he lived with a 27-year headache and various and sundry other ailments of the body as well. So finally, we were to the point where he goes back to Geneva on September 13, 1541, and very quickly is very, very busy. The Genevan Council, in trying to get him back, it sort of reminds me a little bit of... It'd sort of be like if the Suns, okay? The Suns realize, oops, we really messed up last year when we got rid of Jason Kidd. How do we get him back? And they'd offer you all sorts of stuff. Well, he wouldn't come back even if, no matter what we offered. But the Genevan Council, when Calvin was at Strasbourg, he was making one florin a week. That'd be 52 florins a year. That was barely subsistence wage at the time. The Genevan Council, to get him back, and he didn't ask for this and really didn't care about it one way or the other, but the records indicate that they gave him 500 florins a year. So that's a tenfold increase. And I forget how many bags of cornmeal and like 250 gallons of wine, which you may go, whoa, that explains a few things. That was generally used for all sorts of things at that particular point in time and could be bartered for other things, to other necessities of life. I think I mentioned that, even Calvin's enemies had to admit, and there were people like Jerome Bolsec, against whom Calvin wrote a treatise in regards to predestination very early on here in the Second Genevan period, who eventually went back to Rome and wrote just the world's worst biography of Calvin. It was just a error-filled hate piece, which, of course, it becomes the source of much of modern people who want to try to vilify Calvin. And sadly, example of that would be Dave Hunt's new book, When You Don't Care About Being Fair to the Man, then you can find all sorts of stuff to smear him with. They would probably make the accusation, but meaningful people recognized that, money was not an issue for Calvin. He didn't really care about such things. He lived a very frugal life. He wasn't looking at garnering the things of the world in, that sense at all. So he goes back to Geneva in 1541. We have, over the next 8 years, he is, again, very actively involved in reforming the church there. When he comes back, the council in its notes say something along the lines of, we resolve to never let Calvin go again. But as Calvin knew would happen, basically from 1541 to 1555, so 14 years, Calvin struggles horrifically, basically in a declining situation the whole time. He has many enemies. What many people who try to picture him as the ruler of Geneva don't understand is he did not even become a citizen of Geneva until 1559, 5 years before he died. So he is, in essence, a foreigner. He is not, does not have the rights of a citizen. He is the chief minister, and his authority and power came primarily from the fact that the city government was set up to where you had the Council of the 200, you had the little council, and you had the ministers. And much of his difficulty was constantly in the realm of the relationship between the ministers and the secular council. Again, this was, Calvin was a magisterial reformer. This was a state church. And many have noted that though it was not his intention, he really laid the foundations of the destruction of his own system in the sense that there was an inconsistency, at least we would argue that there is an inconsistency, between the tradition of the magisterial type of church-state relationship and the form of biblical exegesis that Calvin insisted that we utilize, and the recognition of the, supremacy of Christ in his church, we would see all the problems that end up developing and did develop as being a result of, the elevation of a, tradition rather than anything else. And, really, if you follow the exegetical methodology of Calvin, you end up having to overthrow much of his perspective in regards to attempting, and this was the greatest source of his frustration through his life, attempting to get unregenerate men to act as if they're regenerate men. Unregenerate men don't want to follow moral laws. They want to basically say, hey, what I do in the privacy of my own life is my own business, and it's not God's business or anybody else's business, and so on and so forth. And so when Calvin, for example, attempts to, it's amazing that many cities in Europe at that time had extremely restrictive laws regarding the length of one's pants that one could wear on the Lord's Day, and yet would have very lax laws in regards to prostitution. There was little consistency there, and Calvin saw that and, attempted to, over time, for example, make the crime of prostitution much more serious than it was almost any place else. And you would think that length of pants and prostitution, you might be able to see where there's a difference there, but these are some of the frustrations that he dealt with. So as I said, we're not going to go into the details, but between 1541 and 1555, there are all sorts of conflicts that Calvin has to deal with. This is a period of time which he writes, the treatise against Pigius, the Roman Catholic, also on the subject of predestination. A lot of his conflicts had to do with two primary areas, Trinitarian theology and the doctrine of predestination. Those were major areas of discussion. He was called upon numerous times to debate before the council on these subjects, because since he had many enemies in Geneva, when someone would come along with a charge against him, it wasn't difficult to find enough allies in the council to have enough votes to bring it up to that level. So he's constantly in a defensive mode at that point, in having to defend himself against the various charges that we brought against him at that time. Now, why 1555 or so, middle 1500s? Well, the biggest issue that we probably hear about and that is thrown up constantly, those of you who've listened to my debate against Dr. Robert Sabin on oneness Pentecostalism will know that here's a fellow who insisted on tremendously long opening statements. He wanted an hour for his opening statement. Unheard of in a debate, at least in the types of debates we do today. Not unheard of in older style debates when you'd be meeting numerous times, but for a single meeting debate, an hour opening is just unheard of. We whittled it down to 40 minutes, as I recall, and insisted on using multimedia. That's why we ended up getting that projector and all the rest of stuff. Well, as I've mentioned to you before, when you listen to the debate, the first about 21 or 22 minutes, maybe even longer than that, now that I think about it, I think he only had 14 minutes left when he finally turned on the projector and started to talk about the subject of the debate. The whole first opening section of his opening statement is about the case of Michael Servetus. And that gives us an indication of just how regularly the story of Servetus is raised today, and it normally is raised within the context of people who have only heard a very, very, very brief, normally very unfair presentation of what actually took place in regards to the subject of Servetus. In fact, the first time I ever really heard much of the word Calvinism was in a Watchtower article about Michael Servetus. And various groups like to latch on to Servetus somewhat as their patron saint, which I find very strange, because if you read his material, there wouldn't really be anybody who would want him as their patron saint. But remember, we met Servetus initially back in the 1530s when Calvin is contacted by this man. A meeting is set up in Paris. Calvin risks himself to go back into Paris for the meeting, and Servetus never shows. And I mentioned then that strikes me as very, very strange in light of what happened later. Let me just give you a bird's eye, just real quick summary, and then we'll go back and look at sections. Why is Servetus important? Servetus was an anti-Trinitarian heretic who had published his views, who was burned in Geneva in 1553, I believe is the year, October 27th. He was the only person burned for heresy. There were many others burned for other things, but for the specific charge of heresy, Servetus was burned in Geneva on October 27th. And he had been condemned by the Inquisition. He had escaped the Inquisition in his nightclothes by jumping up on top of what would be the ancient equivalent of a porta potty and jumping over the fence. Could have disappeared again. He had lived for many years in anonymity, even while publishing his works. He could have done that again, chose not to do so. Many places he could have gone in Europe and hidden, he didn't. He made a beeline for Geneva. And the real question is why? What was it about Servetus? We know that, for example, he maintained a lengthy correspondence with Calvin for years. He did it under an assumed name. It didn't take Calvin long to figure out who it was. Calvin is frequently faulted for having been the one who gave documentation to a friend who then gave it to the inquisitors who then arrested Servetus. But Calvin could have done that years earlier than he did. He tried to reason with the man. He sent him a copy of the Institutes, which he sent back with vile comments written in the margins. He really, for some reason, tried to reason with the man, even when Servetus was arrested in Geneva. Farrell and Calvin both spent hours trying to reason with the man and correct the man. When I look at Servetus, I see a personality that I know a lot about, because I have a lot of Servetuses in my life. This guy was consumed with Calvin. Calvin gave him a reason to exist. He saw in Calvin a person who challenged him. And so his means of affirming his mental superiority and really affirming his own personal faith was through denying what Calvin was saying. And I think the reason that Servetus made a beeline for Geneva is he escaped the night before he was to be burned by the Inquisition. And I think he realized that there was going to be no place safe for him any longer, and therefore, if he's going to die, he wants to go out in glory, shall we say. And so he goes to Geneva. And so he can face Calvin and you know, the great battle. It's sort of like the great battle at the end of Return of the Jedi, you know, Vader versus Skywalker. That's sort of the mindset, I think, that Servetus had. And I can think of individuals, I can think of Roman Catholics, Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, King James only folks, all of whom are just obsessed with trying to respond to those that would say something against their position. And Servetus was a brilliant fellow, but he was unbalanced. He wasn't really rational when it came to theology. And it's very interesting, many of these people, Servetus also was a brilliant medical doctor. And so many of these people that I've met over the years who, on a theological level, are simply wacky, when they walk out the church door, they can be brilliant and balanced. They can be engineers. They can be medical people. They can be fighter pilots. They can be involved in professions that require a lot of mental discipline. And yet, when you leave that area and enter into the theological area, all of a sudden it's just padded cell type thinking. And that's what Servetus is all about. So it's truly fascinating, the story here. As I mentioned, Servetus had lived for quite some time in general anonymity under the name of Michael Villanueva. And he had written his book against the Trinity back, I think it was back in the 1530s. And then he starts this correspondence with Calvin. Calvin figures out who he is, and he sends him a copy of the Institutes. It comes back to him, and this is all being done through intermediate parties, in essence. Servetus recognizes, I mean, think about what Servetus is risking. He's living in Spain at the time. Ever heard of the Spanish Inquisition? No one ever expects the Spanish Inquisition, you know, that kind of thing. He was already taking a tremendous risk. The same fellow who wouldn't show up in Paris to meet Calvin can't help but risking his entire life to correspond with Calvin. And he also has to realize that Calvin is no dummy, and he's going to figure out who he is. And does realize that. and hence is in essence putting himself in Calvin's hands, daring Calvin to reveal him to the authorities in Spain. Now, keep another thing in mind that is rarely thought of when the whole Servetus incident is discussed, and that is one of the apologetic arguments, and it's still in some essence is used today, but was more of a prevalent argument at this point in time. Remember, the Reformation, let's put this at 1550. Okay, nice round number. The Reformation at this time is still relatively young, and one of the arguments that is used by Rome against the Protestants is that without a central, infallible authority, the central aspects and the central doctrines of the faith are going to be denied, and there will be no Christian faith before long in the Protestant churches. And, of course, they would use certain doctrines like transubstantiation or the Mass or whatever as illustrations of this. But more than that, they would then focus upon the things that the Protestants said they believed, but they would say, but see, they actually don't really believe these things. For example, the doctrine of the Trinity. And so when Servetus was caught by the Inquisition and condemned for his teachings, there was nothing new about that. That was going on all the time. And when you published a book against the doctrine of the Trinity, that's exactly what you'd expect would happen. That's why he was living under an assumed name. But when he escaped them, and by the way, the next day they burned him in effigy and along with his books after he got away, when he was arrested by the Protestants, immediately the big question was, well, are the Protestants going to demonstrate that they really don't believe in the doctrine of the Trinity, and are they going to protect the man who is overthrowing that doctrine? And so one of the things that's rarely brought up is that once he was in custody, Geneva sent letters to Bern, the largest of the Swiss cantons. They sent letters to Philip Melanchthon. Luther, of course, had died a few years earlier, so Melanchthon's now the leader of the Lutheran movement, to Heinrich Bullinger in Zurich, who took over from Ulrich Zwingli. And Farrell, all these people, and every letter that came back to Geneva, the Lutherans under Melanchthon, Bullinger, the Reformed in Zurich, Bern, the largest of the Swiss cantons, they all said the exact same thing. The laws must be obeyed in this situation. Servetus has to die. Obviously, it was being watched very, very carefully, and that factor has to be considered in recognizing not only what the city council did, but what the ministers did in the situation as well. Well, back to Servetus earlier on. He is, in essence, playing Russian roulette, knowing that the more people who become involved in this correspondence, the more danger he's living in. I mean, if he just wanted to live a peaceful life, he never would have contacted Calvin, but he didn't want to. There was something, some necessity that drove him to have to challenge the reformer in Geneva. And so eventually what happens is one of Calvin's friends learns that he knows where Servetus is. And he pleads with him earnestly that by protecting Servetus, especially since he's already extended every attempt to communicate with him and correct him, by protecting him, he was, in essence, putting himself in danger of being accused of being complicit with Servetus, and especially since Calvin had already had to defend himself against charges of Trinitarian heresy. This was just foolishness on Calvin's part in every way. Calvin was reluctant to do so. He did not desire at all the Inquisition to ever benefit from anything. But eventually he gives documentation to this friend, who then gives it to another friend, who then gets it into Spain, who gets it to the proper authorities, etc., etc., sufficient information to identify the fact that Michael Villanueva, the medical doctor, is in fact Michael Servetus. Now, Servetus denied this all through his trial before the Inquisition, But the evidence was just overwhelming. And as I said, he was condemned to die. That's so normative for the Inquisition, no one even blinks at that. He was to be burned the next day. And as I mentioned, he, after midnight sometime, went out to use the facilities, jumped up on top of the outhouse-type facility in his nightgown. I guess his jailer figured he wasn't going anywhere in a nightgown. Well, he was wrong. And made a hasty leap over the fence and disappeared out of the control of the Inquisition. And as I mentioned, the next day was burned in effigy along with his books. He had, in fact, I forgot to mention this, had just written a book on the restitution of Christianity, which was, in essence, a response to the institutes of the Christian religion. He had, again, here's a guy who's writing a book in, that is, in essence, in response to Calvin. He's just, he's obsessed. It's a, you know, whatever movies you've seen where there's obsession involved, this is a historical and theological example of obsession. And so he, as I mentioned, escapes and makes a beeline for Geneva. Now, no one hypothesizes that he thought he'd be safe there. No one hypothesizes that, well, you know, Calvin didn't reveal my identity for so long, and therefore I'd be safe there. That he would have to have been completely whacked to have come up with that kind of an idea. Instead, and there's dispute at this point. Different histories related differently. He attended services in Geneva on Sunday morning. He even went to the very church that he knew Calvin would be preaching in. Now, to my knowledge, Calvin would not have had any idea of what Servetus looked like. They had not met in that way, so how he'd be recognized is hard to say. One of the stories is that he sat in the back, was recognized and arrested. One of the stories is he marched right down the front pew and, in essence, made himself known and hence was arrested. Truth's probably somewhere in between those two. In any case, he, I think, arrived Saturday and on Sunday morning makes sure to attend services where Calvin's preaching. Again, not the actions of a person who wants to remain anonymous. Did he know about the fact that at this point things had reached a crisis stage in Geneva and Calvin had the largest number of enemies he'd ever had in positions of power and authority on the council? I don't know. We really don't know. We do know that once he is arrested, he immediately draws to his defense Calvin's enemies, including those on the council. He seeks to have Calvin imprisoned. There was actually a law that if you brought charges against someone, then you had to either go into prison at the same time until the issue was resolved. Boy, would that change the legal system. Or you had to, in essence, hire someone to go in your place. And since you might say, well, why would that be relevant to Calvin? Well, Calvin, as the chief minister, since this is a theological issue, it fell to the ministers to prefer the charges against Servetus because the charges were of a theological nature, of a nature of heresy. Tried to have Calvin imprisoned, and to have someone did go into prison under that law, but it was someone that the ministers hired to do so, in essence, which was the common way of doing it. Servetus tried to have that undermined and Calvin himself thrown in. He also tried to use, and how he would have known about this, unless he had had some contact with Calvin's enemies in Geneva, I don't know, but there was a particular provision that if he was unsuccessful in his prosecution, would have given to Servetus all of Calvin's physical possessions, including his house. He had that motion placed before the council as well. And it was this became the galvanizing situation where Calvin's enemies saw their opportunity here. They had a brilliant man in Servetus. He could speak very well. And they very foolishly, in hindsight, rushed to his aid and saw this as their opportunity to have Calvin overthrown. During this period of time, Calvin, as I said, mentioned before, meets with Servetus a number of times. Before the council, before the legal governing bodies, they debate the issues. Calvin refutes what Servetus has to say. The primary issue that Servetus is focusing on is the denial of the eternal nature of the Son. The Son is a creature who became divine. But that's why both the Oneness Pentecostals and the Jehovah's Witnesses try to make reference to him, is because he didn't believe exactly like either one of them, but you could grab hold of statements that you can apply to either perspective. It's ironic in a sense, because the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Oneness Pentecostals, while they both deny the doctrine of the Trinity, do so for different reasons and come to very different conclusions. Oneness Pentecostals, of course, believe that Jesus was two persons. He was the Father and the Son. And they would say, at least initially, that they firmly believe in the deity of Christ. What they don't believe in is that the Son has eternally existed as a divine person. And the Jehovah's Witnesses would focus upon what Servetus said about the Son being a creature, because they also say the Son is a creature. He's Michael the Archangel, the first and greatest of all of God's creations. So it's interesting that both groups, you know, tend to pull from him. Servetus would actually fit more with the Oneness Pentecostals than he would with Jehovah's Witnesses. But anyways, they like to use him because he was anti-Trinitarian and got burned, and therefore he's good and everybody else is bad. So we have debates going on. We have Calvin both publicly and privately attempting to deal with him. But meanwhile, Servetus not only does not show any interest whatsoever in being corrected, and in fact had the attitude that no one could. No one could possibly correct him. And again, as I read the histories, I cannot help but actually physically see individuals that I know who are just modern-day Servetuses, as far as their attitude goes, that I know personally. So once the council comes to its decision on the basis of the trial, which Calvin has to be the lead prosecutor of, again, because it's a religious issue of heresy, and then all the unanimous response of all of the other churches to which Geneva made appeal. Geneva actually sent the documents of the trial to Bern, to Zurich, to Wittenberg, and all the major sources, all the major centers responded unanimously with the verdict of condemnation and the verdict of death. Now, as is well known, but isn't always mentioned, once that verdict was reached and announced, the ministers came to the council and asked that the means of execution be changed from fire to sword, that it be done quickly and not in a extended way. Their plea was turned down. And so when the execution took place, if I recall correctly, and this is a little bit foggy, so I could be wrong about this, as I recall correctly, even to the very end, Farrell was involved in seeking to try to get Servetus to change his mind, which is sort of funny when you think about it. Farrell was not the theological mind that Servetus was, as far as on a scholarly level, but he was the passionate one, and he continues to the very end to seek to get Servetus to recant. Servetus is executed, and when Calvin's enemies outside of Geneva attempt to use this, and again, if this was happening all the time, why would Servetus be the only one that gets all the attention? Well, because it wasn't happening all the time. There were all sorts of other infractions which people were punished or imprisoned or even killed in Geneva, but this was, for example, witchcraft was, again, any type of time there was a plague or anything like that, people still believed that witchcraft was behind it. And so in the mid-1540s, that had taken place. But for heresy specifically, Servetus was the prime example of this. And Calvin's enemies, when they then utilized this, even though it wouldn't have mattered where this had happened. If it had been in Bern, Wittenberg, his name might be a footnote in history, but it happened in Geneva. Calvin's responses were not good, in the sense that they were rather shrill. And that didn't help, and in fact, probably aided in the publishing of a book very shortly thereafter, seeking to present the idea of clemency for heretics, in the sense of not using the sword for theological crimes. And so, rather unwittingly, I would assume, Calvin's poor response to the criticisms of the action, rather than saying, look at the unanimity of everyone here, instead of responding in that way, there was much more of an emotional type response to it. And as a result, probably unwittingly, he helped to actually further the eventual elimination of these types of prosecutions, even though it still took a long time, and the chief people who suffered for that kind of theological prosecution by government were not anti-Trinitarian heretics, they were Baptists. I mean, throughout the history of Europe, I've mentioned many times the fact that a Baptist was executed in London in 1611, same year the King James Version of the Bible came out. I've just always found that so ironic. And that continued on for quite some time. So that, in a nutshell, is the Servetus incident. Yes, sir? He was his own self. I think he really viewed himself as beyond anyone else. I mean, when you say he was Roman Catholic, well, certainly he was raised that way. But he would not, Rome condemned him as well. He sort of viewed himself as a prophet, as a person with insight that no one else had. So to identify him is pretty difficult. Yes, sir. Was that hand up? No. Okay, no hand up. Okay. Corner of your Bible, half frayed. Oh, okay, so. Anyways, that whole incident is certainly, we look back on it now and it gives us much information concerning what sacralism, what the Magisterial Reformation was all about. And there is no way of defending what happened there or in Wittenberg, because it had been happening in Wittenberg for decades before this. It's just that because of Calvin's name, this one becomes the most famous. It's rarely fairly presented, and it's real easy, given that people today never contextualize anything, never put anybody in their history. If a church in our day, grabbed a Jehovah's Witness and lit him up in the backyard, I mean, that's the kind of emotional impact that people want to think this was about. It wasn't, but that's what they want to say. But still, it's important to have all the facts concerning what actually took place. Learn a lot about the issue of sacralism, the Magisterial Reformation, in that incident, as well as all the others that are really just footnotes in history. The ones in Zurich, the ones in Bern, the ones in Wittenberg, that just don't get nearly the amount of press that this one in Geneva got because of its high-profile nature. So, okay? Well, I have, according to that super accurate watch or clock on the back wall, have exhausted my time. So let us close the word of prayer. Father, again, we thank you for this opportunity of gathering together. We do pray that we will learn what has happened in the past, that we will be very thankful for the freedoms that we have, the freedom that we have to dialogue and to preach the truth. Father, help us to recognize that there are many forces who would take these freedoms from us, to be thankful for them and to use them as best we can while we still have them. And as we have freedom to gather together in worship now, we pray that you would be with us, that you would guide and direct. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.